Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In the days after the deadly storming of the U.S. Capitol, conspiracy theorist Alex Jones released a video revealing some details about who paid for the rally before the riot.
We went and paid for it. Well, thank God a donor came in that paid for like 80% of it, because it cost close to $500,000 for all the equipment, all the stages, and the rest of it.
Mike Spies, that donor who paid for 80% of the rally that Alex Jones is talking about, who is he talking about, Mike?
He's talking about Julie Jenkins Vancelli, who is the heiress to the Publix supermarket franchise.
Okay. This is Mike Spies. He's a reporter at ProPublica. And tell us a little bit more about how Julie Jenkins Vancelli, the heiress to the Publix supermarket corporation or franchise, as you said, how did she get involved in funding the rally?
It's a very circuitous route, but the conduit, if you will, was the noted and infamous conspiracy theorist Alex Jones, who runs the website InfoWars and is known for pushing conspiracy theories about mass shootings being false flag operations, and also questioning whether 9/11 was actually something that was carried out by the government, or similar conspiracy theories.
And so did she know Jones, or what's the connection there?
Yeah, so it's interesting. It's not their relationship is actually not, sort of in some ways it's still a mystery. I mean, what happened was there was a person named Cindy Shafian who was working with Jones to hold an event on the 6th, and he got in touch with her one day and he said, I have a funder who wants to give quite a bit of money, or there's a funder I know of that wants to give quite a bit of money. She's a sort of major Republican donor. In order to make that happen, you have to talk to her, basically her fundraising handler, if you will. And that person is named Caroline Wren. And that's sort of the nexus of that relationship.
Caroline Wren. Okay. So, I mean, the details really matter here when we're trying to follow the money, right? So tell us more about how Caroline Wren is connected. Is she connected, and how, to the Trump campaign?
Yes. So Caroline Wren was a major, and she served as the deputy to, and a lot of names here, so I'm sorry. She served as the deputy to Kimberly Guilfoyle, who is the girlfriend of Donald Trump Jr. and was sitting at the top of Trump Victory, which is was the joint fundraising committee for the president's reelection campaign. So the two of them basically worked hand in glove over the last election cycle to bring in as much big donor money as possible.
Okay. And so the organizations through which this big money was funneled. First of all, how much did Julie Jenkins Vancelli contribute?
What's been reported is she contributed some $300,000, which would account for most of the supposedly $500,000 that went into putting on the January 6th rally.
Okay. And so what were the specific organizations that money or other big money went to that were behind the January 6th rally?
Well, I suspect that the January 6th rally was ultimately hosted by a relatively new nonprofit called Women for America First. And that started by a mother-daughter team, the Kramers, Amy Kramer and Kylie Kramer. Amy came up and became sort of a name in the Tea Party movement and has sort of been moving in that rightward direction ever since. And I think that the Kramers had also some previous relationship with Jones, though, according to the woman I brought up earlier, Cindy Shafian, they had some kind of a falling out a while ago. But that group was the primary group that was attached to the January 6th rally, that the only one, in fact.
Okay. At least on paper, right?
At least on paper, yes. Yeah.
Okay. Right. So Mike, hang on here for just a second, because this hour we're talking about the money that's behind the events of that January 6th rally that came before the insurrection at the Capitol. And we're trying to understand also where that money or those big donors are going now. Where is that money going now as politics continues to churn on in the United States? So I want to bring in Meredith McGeehee into the conversation. She's executive director at Issue One, a nonpartisan nonprofit group that's focused on reforming American politics. She also has expertise in money and ethics in politics. Meredith, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So why is the money trail here regarding the events of January 6th, the rally and then the riot, why is it significant in this case?
Well, I think it's important that everyone realizes many of these mass gatherings, regardless of which side on the ideological spectrum they're representing, and simply by accident, many times renting buses, getting them organized, getting speakers, getting the equipment, that all takes a fair chunk of change. And so I've been in Washington for many years. You know, when you see these large gatherings of people, that there is always some degree of money behind it. And, it's always important in American politics for the American people to have a sense of who is trying to influence the outcome of both our elections as well as our policymaking. So you look at what happened on the 6th, organized money to bring people to Washington, and then knowing, as the former President Trump had promised, that it was going to be wild, to quote him. Mm-hmm. And so, this is a pretty combustible cocktail that was all arriving on the Mall on January 6th.
But let's just make it clear. I mean, to your point about anytime there's a big rally in Washington, got to ask where the money's come from. And we've seen all sorts of big rallies in Washington. I mean, the Women's March was huge as well. So it's the same set of questions. Is there any sort of meaningful difference here?
In the sense of being able to bring a large group of people and have funding about it, I should first note that there's really hardly any requirements in law to have transparency about that. It's due to the good reporting of people like Mike and others that began to kind of peel back that curtain and let people have a bit of vision into that. It's nothing wrong with having these large gatherings, nothing wrong with having them financed. The difference here, I think, was that it was clear in this case that in addition to having a First Amendment rally, which I, hope everyone in listening to this would support, is that there were other people involved in this that had a much more nefarious purpose and were using it basically as a staging ground to really complete the insurrection.
Mm. And so, Mike, let me turn back to you. Do we know any more about who those other people are?
Not yet. I mean, we know Jones himself had pledged some $50,000 and then also had bankrolled an event that happened, a related event that happened the day before on January 5th at Freedom Plaza. It's absolutely correct. It's a Women for America First, like many of these groups, is a 501c4 nonprofit, and the appeal of giving money for certain people to such groups is that there is no requirement to disclose who the donors are. And in fact, that's why you do it. I mean, in this case, you sometimes get lucky, as we did here.
So Mike, hang over, your line's kind of dropping in and out. Can you just repeat that sentence? You said sometimes you get lucky, and meaning what? We're going to try and get him back. Obviously, that line is not good. So, Meredith, let me turn back to you. So let's focus on something that you said a moment ago. Finding out who the actual donors are, because so much of it is dark money, as you and Mike are talking about, is going to be difficult. But you also said what wasn't difficult to understand was the intent of the rally, right? Because as you said, the President Trump at the time had said it was, you know, sent out that tweet saying, "Be there, it will be wild." And then I think it was just the next day, the New York Times has reported that the next day a new website called Wild Protest popped up, and it was connected to Ali Alexander, the conspiracy theorist who had very vocally vowed to stop the electoral certification process and said he was going to march hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people to sit their quote-unquote butts in D.C. and close the city down. So the intent wasn't hidden.
Correct. And, you know, the danger here is that in the end, and this is something I've talked about for many years, that when you have a democratic republic like we have, you have a confidence game, right? You have an idea that's at the base of this is that you are not having a direct democracy. You are electing people to represent you. And then you have the public in general has to have faith in two things. One, that the people that end up being representatives are in fact the people they voted for, and two, that those representatives are going to put the public interest above their personal interest. So those are two very important building blocks, the foundation of our system. And what happened over the last several months is that there was a direct attack on both of those. There was attack on whether or not the elected representatives, including the president, were accurately elected. And there was an attack on whether or not they really are putting their own selfish interests over the interests of the American people. So when this rally came up, it was building on this fraudulent narrative that had been fanned both by President Trump and others, that somehow there was fraud, regardless of repeated instances where these allegations had been brought to the court,
Meredith
which
McGee,
is our system.
Yep, hang on here for just a quick second. We have to take a quick break. I want to hear you finish that thought when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're trying to follow the money this hour that went into funding the January 6th rally that took place before the riot at the Capitol, and wanting to know where that money is going now. I'm joined today by Meredith McGeehy. She's executive director at Issue One, a nonpartisan nonprofit organization that focuses on money in politics. Mike Spees also joins us. He's a reporter for ProPublica. His latest piece in ProPublica is headlined, "Text Messages Show Top Trump Campaign Fundraisers Key Role in Planning the Rally That Preceded the Siege." Now, Mike, I think we have you back on a little bit of a better line now. How much more can we say, or do you know, did we find out about how the Trump campaign itself was tied in to the rally financially?
I mean, it seems like, I mean, Wren was the central figure in that. I mean, though, to be clear, Wren had finished her work for the campaign in November before moving on to organizing this rally in December. We're talking about the campaign right now, but it also should be clear that the White House was very directly apprised of how the event was coming together in the days leading up to it, receiving updates through another person who served as sort of a go-between. I think her name's Katrina Pearson. And then just in addition to what we ultimately unearthed, which was that someone like Wren was overseeing budget, planning, messaging, logistics, there's also just the evidence that's just right in front of your face that can't really be ignored, which is almost, it's too obvious that it almost can, you know, you can look past it, which is just the president, as was pointed out earlier, encouraging people to come, saying it's going to be wild, eventually, you know, promoting the event, going to the event, and then basically telling people to march on the Capitol, also telling them that he would in fact join them, which he did not. It really did, in many ways, just play out right in front of our faces, right in front of our eyes.
Mm. But Meredith, can we? There's sort of a standard here regarding intent, right? I mean, people and everyone who's been talked to about who attended the rallies, and no one supports the violence that happened. So. Is there a standard of intent here that can be met?
Well, there were some people, obviously, that did support the violence. And I think what you saw was that the organizing that Mike identified and the money behind that provided, if you will, the shell for all the other folks. It, in fact, came with a plan, whether it was the Proud Boys or the Oath Keepers or many others. And, it was somewhat of an open secret that there were these elements that were going to use January 6th for their staging ground. And so, if you were someone who had come as a regular citizen, you got bused in one of these buses that, let's say, the public there paid for, maybe you did not have an idea to come and overtake and run, go into the Capitol and result in death. But there were other elements that were certainly going to do that. The intelligence chatter was hearing about it. Those of us just tracking kind of the messages back and forth, not even being in the intelligence community, it was very clear that this was going to be an element, a part of the January 6th crowd. And so I don't think anyone was very surprised. The other part of this, other than the money, is that there were messages going back and forth in the intelligence community and in the military community where, there was an order apparently by the acting attorney general saying, don't give anybody the police batons, don't give them helmets, don't do these things. This is because they knew there was going to be an element that came intent on violence.
Huh. And there was also the report from NBC News last month about organizations like the Republican Attorney General's Association that had sent out robocalls encouraging people to actually march on the Capitol, saying that at 1 p.m. we will march to the Capitol building and call on Congress to stop the steal. So, how many organizations are we potentially talking about here?
Well, I think it's Mike, you may have better information. I know of at least, 7 or 8 that were identified by name, but you may have more information about that than I do.
Oh, you're right. No, I think some 10 or so groups that were identified that were either, the Republican Attorney's General affiliate, which was responsible for robocalls, I think was sort of unique in that regard. I think most of the other groups involved were providing transportation. I mean, the most right. prominent one that I could think of, and most of those groups, I think, by the way, would not register with the average person. They're not like widely known. But the one that stuck out the most to me was Turning Point USA, which has been very closely aligned. Very closely tied to the Trump administration. Its leader, Charlie Kirk, is very close with Don Jr., the president, and other members of his administration frequently appear at Turning Point events. In fact, in late December, a couple weeks before the rally, Turning Point held a conference in Florida that featured some of the speakers, or at least one of the speakers that would show up at the January 6th rally and speak, and that was the new congressman, the freshman congressman, Madison Cawthorn. And at that event, he told the crowd that it was okay for them to, quote, lightly threaten their congressman.
Hmm. Well, so for, I think the reason why this is so hard to suss out is that dark money is dark by design, right? But Meredith, I also don't want to necessarily fall into the trap of sounding like there's sort of, you know, one or two sets of people pulling all the strings here when it comes to right-wing politics and money in the United States, or any politics, quite frankly. But specifically in the situation where we are now, you've talked about how there's just different kinds of political money, right? There's, I think you call it ideological versus what, strategic money going into politics. Can you tell me the difference?
So you have to think of political money coming in and, you know, kind of from all around. And it's a 360-degree experience. Some of it is given through what many people now know of, political action committees. That's all reported. You see it. It's very clear. Some goes to leadership PACs. Some may go to trade associations. And so you have a lot of information about that money. But it's only really the tip of the iceberg of the political money that is sloshing around in Washington, particularly after the Citizens United decision. That decision by the Supreme Court back in 2010 kind of drew a roadmap about how to spend money to influence the outcomes of both elections and policy in Washington without having to be seen in public. So it's kind of a stark contrast to all of the light that's on, you know, the individual money given to candidates and the PAC money that's given to candidates. In the last 4 years, there were changes in the rules in the IRS to even lessen the amount of information that is available both to the government and to the public about all this other political money that's coming into the system. None of this is intended in any way to say that money is inherently evil. None of this is intended to say you shouldn't be able to express your First Amendment rights. Oh. What we do know is that the ability to mobilize very large amounts of money empowers those people like the Irish that Mike described to have an outsized influence about what happens in Washington.
Mm. Well, I want to focus for just a second on corporate money in particular, because in the wake of the Capitol attack, several major corporations announced that they were halting PAC donations to Republicans of members of Congress who voted against certifying election results. And recent campaign finance reports are revealing which corporations were the biggest donors to those politicians.
You know, top industry lobbying groups, defense companies, you know, even well-known companies like Comcast or Home Depot.
That's Carl Evers Hillstrom. He's with the Nonpartisan Center for Responsive Politics, and they track money in U.S. politics and its effect on policy. And Evers Hillstrom says that corporations often don't base their political donations on ideology, but instead for political favor and influence.
Corporate PACs donate to incumbent lawmakers on both sides. And a lot of the Republican objectors were in very safe Republican seats, which are exactly the kind of seat that a corporate PAC would like to donate to, because it's unlikely that they'll lose it.
But campaign finance reports reveal only so much. I mean, what about that dark money that we've been talking about here? Funds filtered through groups such as America First Policies. How much money was donated through groups like that to organizers of the January 6th rally?
There are also a lot of dark money groups, including America First Policies, which is closely aligned with the Trump campaign that helped organize the rally. Since these groups don't disclose their donors, we have no idea who might be funding them. It could be anyone from those ideologically conservative donors to corporations. We simply have no idea, unfortunately.
Now, as we talked about earlier, the January 6th rally was organized by a group called Women for America First. That, too, is essentially a dark money organization. They're not required to disclose their donors. But it has been reported that that other group, America First Policies, which is a pro-Trump policy organization, dark money organization. In 2019, they did disclose that they had contributed to Women for America for some $25,000, according to CNBC. So occasionally we get glimpses into how the money flows, but overall, oftentimes the public simply has no idea. But politicians who accept such dark money donations, they have more than just an idea.
So the public has no idea what kind of favors these funders are gaining by helping them with dark money, whereas the politicians do know who these people are.
And that information asymmetry is by design. It's a creation of campaign finance laws. But beyond what we know about who paid for the rally on January 6th, we also know more about former President Trump's finances post-office. Evers Hillstrom reported on Trump's big post-election fundraising haul. Trump now has more than $100 million in his campaign accounts.
So as this sort of infighting between the GOP continues, Trump has a lot of money that he could use to influence that. He could use that money to help primary his political opponents like Liz Cheney, those Republicans who voted to impeach him. And he has a massive base of supporters that he can continually go to for money, whereas other Republicans like Cheney and Kinzinger really don't have that automatic money that they can pull from in order to help them and other like-minded Republicans sort of win this battle.
Carl Evers Hillstrom is with the Nonpartisan Center for Responsive Politics. Now, Meredith McGeehee, to the last point that Carl was making there about former President Trump's current funding that he has in his account, in his campaign accounts, it's much of it's from small donors who we would ostensibly know who they are, right? So there's no issue there. That's a normal part of American politics, is it not?
It is, but I think it's important to have people understand that where the money is going, the type of account that it appears much of this money is going into is something called a leadership PAC. And what's different than a regular PAC here is that they are not subject, for example, to the rules governing personal use. So if you wanted to go out and buy a yacht with your leadership PAC money, there are actually no rules on the books that would keep you as a politician from doing that. They do apply to your authorized campaign committee. So these leadership PACs, which many, many politicians have, almost every member of Congress now has, really are these political slush funds with very few constraints. And so he has a political slush fund that has been financed by his supporters and really can be used almost any way that he chooses. There will be some disclosure, which is good, about some of those expenditures. I would note that sometimes the Federal Election Commission doesn't do a great job of ensuring that there's clarity. If you say you spent that money on paying your Visa bill, but you don't know what the Visa bill was spent on, that's not a lot of clarity. But it's very important for people to realize that a leadership PAC is a different kind of committee than an authorized campaign committee.
Mike Spies, did you want to comment on that?
I think it's just a perfect illustration or scale model of how utterly insane and moronic our campaign finance system is and how little sense it makes. There's like no justification for something like that existing. And our laws, it should be people should be reminded over and over again that they don't make any sense, that they give an unholy amount of power to a generally small group of people, or in this case, they allow someone like the former president to just have a pile of money that he can do whatever he wants with. For no good reason at all, except perhaps to preserve a certain amount of power. It can't be overstated, like the lack of regulation that we have right now and how bad it is for democracy. And people should be reminded of that every single day, because the problem is it's sort of boring to talk about. It's kind of hard to, like, you know, I, having produced a number of campaign finance stories, it's just, understandably hard to pull people in and to make it clear why it matters so much. But it obviously really does. And it's sort of sad.
But Meredith McGeehee, Citizens United, the case essentially sort of codified into, not codified, but affirmed into law the axiom of, you know, you can put your money where your mouth is, that all of we have this system now because part of the ideological backing for it is that it is a way for people to have their say through how politics are funded in the United States. And we got to take a quick break, so I'm going to get your answer to sort of that question in a second. So Meredith and Mike, hang on here. We're trying to follow the money, both light and dark, that went into what happened in the attack on the Capitol on January 6th. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In just a couple of minutes, we're going to hear from an international observer of the United States who survived a domestic attack on his country's government several years ago and his warning for America. We'll hear that in just a couple of minutes. But right now, we're wrapping up our conversation about the money that went into the January 6th rally that preceded the riot on Capitol Hill. And Meredith McGee, I wanted to hear from you your response to what Mike Spies was saying before the break about this. Perhaps if there's a feeling of inevitability that if so much money can move so cryptically through American politics, that should we have seen something like what happened on January 6th coming?
Oh, absolutely. I think people forget sometimes that there was another portion to the Citizens United decision that was by a margin of 8-1. And that was the court deciding that the requirements for disclosure were constitutional. And unfortunately, in response to that, the agency that's supposed to enforce it has been AWOL. It spent much of its time over the last several years not having the number of commissioners, and it's a pretty weak agency. But actually, the court has made clear that at a minimum, this disclosure is very constitutional. You know, there's different pieces here. There's campaign money, which is treated one way under the law. There's the money that comes into organizations that say their main purpose is lobbying. And then there's money that comes into so-called C3s that are supposed to be charitable and educational organizations. And it is a maze of regulations and laws, as I'm sure everyone can imagine. What the end result is here is that trying to go and do what Mike has done and find out, like, who's really behind this, who's financing this effort, is almost impossible to do through public records. And it's almost impossible for an average American to have a sense, as the court has said repeatedly, that the American people have a right to know who is trying to influence the outcome of policymaking and campaigns. And so we have a system currently that is so obscure, so opaque, that it is very difficult for the American people to be well informed about the money being spent to affect their lives. And so I'm really glad to see the work that Mike did in trying to peel back some of these layers and to put together that jigsaw puzzle.
Mm. Well, we have just a little over a minute here, Meredith. I'm curious what you think about the fact that the money that we can trace, some of it at least, like direct donations to campaigns, for example, Josh Hawley had his biggest campaign haul in recent memory after what happened on January 6th, and much of that was coming from small donors. Some average donation to him in January was $52. So the money still is telling us something regarding where it's going in Republican politics.
Well, it's telling us that what we see in the Senate, we have a very polarized country. We've had several elections now where, the person who won the popular vote did not win the Electoral College. We have a very polarized Congress. And, the Congress is a reflection of the population. It's really not that much different than what you see in the public. And while I think small donor money is actually a good development, mm-hmm. it often can be, as we saw in the days of Jesse Helms, very ideological money that rewards the more extreme parts of the party. So that's when you have to start talking about why is this system as screwed up as it is, that the more extreme you are, the more rewarded you get.
Well, Meredith McGeehee, Executive Director at Issue One, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
And Mike Spies, reporter at ProPublica. We've got links to his latest piece about who funded the January 6th rally. Mike, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
How does the world see America's insurrection, the election and lies that preceded it, and the politics that followed it? What do they see that we Americans can't see ourselves? Indy Samarajiva lives in Colombo, Sri Lanka. He's worried that Americans aren't worried enough about what's happening to U.S. democracy.
There's a sense that, you're protected by not feeling these things, and these feelings are there for a reason, to guide you through reality. Stop trying to be comforted all the time. I think Americans are like children sometimes. You're not children, you're adults. Sometimes you have to face the harsh reality of the world and do something about it.
And what is that harsh reality? Well, on November 10th, months before the insurrection, Samarajiva posted an extended article on Medium. He wrote, quote, "You're being cooed."
What else do you call it? So you give the guy who lost all the power and all the guns for a good 2-3 months. So he had all that. And it's only because people are polite that that hasn't turned into a hard coup. But Donald Trump is not polite. So he changed the defense secretaries. He changed all the people in charge of the guns. And then he went across the street from the Capitol and he told people to go and walk on the Capitol. If that isn't a coup, God knows what is. If it helps you, imagine that it's brown or black people. And then you'll definitely call it a coup.
However, this isn't a tanks and helicopters kind of coup. Samarajiva calls what's happening in the U.S. a stupid coup, characterized by things like a presidential lawyer gesticulating at Four Seasons Total Landscaping.
Oh my goodness, all the networks! Wow! All the networks!
QAnon conspiracies.
Do you believe that there are Democrats and celebrities who are in a pedophile ring?
Well, yes.
Where does that come from, that belief?
Where does that come from? Why don't you ask the little kids?
A guy with face paint, wearing horns and bellowing from the Senate president's chair. Samarajiva gets it. Whether the coup fails or not, deep structural damage is done, he writes. At the time, however, it just feels dumb. Now, I know, yes, people died at the Capitol that day, and yes, members of Congress feared for their lives. But Samarajiva understands the soothing allure of just calling it all a farce and forgetting about it. He knows because he lived through it. What he calls Sri Lanka's stupid coup of 2018.
I was putting the kids to bed one night, and then I got an SMS saying that the president had replaced the leader of the House. And I was like, holy.
The coup was a farce at the time, but how soon it turned to tragedy, Samarajiva writes. They called it a constitutional crisis, but how soon it became a real one.
Well, our top story, Sri Lanka's parliament has been disrupted for a second day with lawmakers allied to the disputed Prime Minister Mahinda Rajapakse hurling chairs at the marshals and allegedly throwing chili powder.
It was a presidential coup. Like, the president abused the powers they had. And because he couldn't just bribe enough people to come over, they tried to basically use violence in parliament. But again, not at the scale that you guys had. We didn't have people die. They just threw chili powder and chairs.
They are throwing chili powder at the speaker. Parliament has been adjourned.
It was crazy. The speaker of the house is this old dude. He's like 80-something now. And there were cops like surrounding him with literally cushions because people were throwing books and like broken chairs at him. There's like one photograph where some of our guys, they scared the speaker of the house away and they went and sat in his chair. And they were sort of like taking pictures in a chair they shouldn't be sitting in. And I saw the same thing happening in America, where some of your mob was sitting in the chair and like taking photos in a chair they shouldn't be sitting in. It's a symbolic thing, but it's also a very real thing because they're occupying your seat of power.
In his Medium essay, Samarajiva writes, "I'm trying to warn you, America. It seems stupid now, but the consequences are not."
What I write about in that article is how, like, a coup is like a blow, right? So someone can stop hitting you and you're still injured. And we were still injured. And that had really long-term repercussions for us. Yeah, it definitely changed the country. I mean, I think what people don't realize is by the time it gets to that point, your country is already divided. And those fault lines would just sort of fracture as the months went on.
The Sri Lankan slow-motion soft coup began in October 2018. Protests followed, as did several orders from the nation's highest court. By December 2018, the coup ended, and Sri Lanka's incumbent president was reinstated.
After the coup happened, our government was destabilized. And at the time, I sort of went back to business. We got our old government back, and I was like, okay, we can just go on with this. But what I didn't realize is that, you know, your government is doing something all the time.
Just 4 months later, Sri Lanka suffered one of the most horrific terrorist attacks in the country's history.
So what happened to us was a lot of national security alerts were missed, or they weren't passed around because the government was still fighting within itself. And then we got hit with a major terrorist attack on Easter Sunday.
On April 21st, 2019, a series of coordinated suicide bombings devastated Sri Lanka.
As you mentioned, this is the eighth blast that has been reported from Sri Lanka alone.
Almost 270 people were killed, many murdered while attending Easter services.
Three were churches, three were hotels, very prominent hotels in Colombo.
It was an act of domestic terrorism. All eight suicide bombers were Sri Lankan citizens associated with the local militant Islamist group. Just weeks earlier, Indian intelligence services had warned Sri Lankan authorities of a possible attack, but that intel was never properly shared within the Sri Lankan government.
And that, to me, was a direct result of the weakening of our government that happened after the coup.
My wife and children were at church that day, Indy Samarajiva writes. Our regular church, where they hadn't gone, had bombs on either side. I couldn't understand the news when I first got it, and you cannot understand the fear until they were safely home. I do not want you to understand, he writes, but I fear one day you must.
So you had a weakening of your government. And to be quite honest, this very, very obvious terrorist signals coming from your white supremacist. This thing's ringing like a five-alarm bell, right? You guys have people actively, like, whipped into a religious fervor about, you know, we need to stop the steal, we need to fight all. And they've been building up to this for decades. And I think your own intelligence agencies track this.
So what happens next? What lessons does Sri Lanka's very recent history of stupid coups and sickening violence have for the United States? Well, Samarajiva writes, quote, "The tragic thing, which you do not understand, which you cannot understand, is that you've already lost. You cannot know exactly what. That's the nature of chaos."
So when I say you've already lost, look, a coup, I'll keep going back to it, but a coup is a blow. So if someone hits you and they stop hitting you, you've already been hit in the face. And so you already have some damage. So what's happened to America is you've already had the heart of your government hit. So you've already taken some damage. Your government is already weakened.
He warns that a damaged government can stay weak for a very long time.
What happened in our coup is that the dudes who staged the coup are like ministers now. Like what they did was they destabilized and they caused all this chaos. And they said, hey, look at the chaos, vote for us. And that's a pretty effective strategy. So it's not like it just stops on inauguration day. What I try to tell readers is, look, in Sri Lanka, this was a generational change. Our cycle of violence started when I was 0 years old, and it went till I was about 30.
He's talking about the Sri Lankan civil war there, one that bled across the nation's history from 1983 to 2009.
So you guys are at the beginning, you're at the beginning of a cycle of violence. And that's just one thing I hope Americans can understand. I think maybe you guys kind of want the Amazon Prime subscription to history where everything gets resolved tomorrow. You know, you want next day delivery on resolution. And I'm telling you, it doesn't work like that. And so it'll take a generational movement for this sort of thing to resolve. I think a lot of people might find that scary to hear, but then there's also some hope in that. If you are nice to your children, then your children can maybe, what I say is this. I don't know if you're allowed to say that.
But hoping for generational change is also a form of denial in the present. It's Americans today proffering nothing more than a powerless shrug and dumping a broken country onto the backs of its children. We have already asked them to bear too much. So we asked Indy Samarajiva, how does a nation defeat at least the willful blindness that hurts a democracy? What can be done now to beat back the stupid part of the stupid coup?
So I guess there's two things I would say to the U.S. One is, like, you're in pain. Like, I think you need to feel that, and you need to feel that things are bad. I think a lot of people might be trying to tell you, oh, it's not so bad, it's not so bad. And it's like sometimes things are just bad. And I feel like pain is your body's way of telling you, like, I'm running into something, I'm hurt, like, don't do this anymore. And I would tell you that black people or, say, undocumented people, they've been saying, hey, like, something's hurting us for a long time, and you haven't listened. And now it's come close to you. So this idea of American exceptionalism, the idea that bad things can happen to you, look, bad things are happening to you, and you need to feel that pain. I don't know what you do with that information, but my only message to you is the denial is just getting you more hurt. It's just causing more damage. It's just causing more trauma. And my other message is that people all over the world who you may have been used to looking down on, we've all gone through similar experiences. And you can sort of look to us and you can learn from the mistakes we've made, because God knows we made a lot of mistakes. And that can help you. And I think this is actually a chance for Americans to leave the exceptional la-la land they've lived in and to rejoin the rest of the world. But God knows it's going to be a painful awakening.
Indy Samarajiva is a writer living in Colombo, Sri Lanka. We have links to his I Lived Through series at onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Jack Beatty, Jonathan Chang, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Hilary McQuilkin, James Ross, Dori Scheimer, Tim Skog, Grace Tatter, and Sydney Wertheim. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.